Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud, where we explore the intersections of Mormonism, current events, and scholarly thought. I'm your host, Margaret Olson Hemming, the co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. I'm speaking today with Amanda Beardsley, who is our art editor and is also faculty at San Diego State University. Her research and publications have ranged from sound studies and feminism and Mormon culture to science and technology studies, gender, and faith. She is the co-editor of Latter-day Saint Art, a Critical Reader, published by Oxford University Press in 2024, and she is the author of an article in the spring 2026 issue of Dialogue about BYU protest dissent and meme culture and art. So, Amanda, welcome to Dialogue Out Loud.
Hi, Margaret. Thank you so much for having me.
So, for those who have not read the article, would you share your thesis and what you describe in your piece?
Yeah, I can also kind of give a backstory, because this was kind of my entrance into Dialogue as the art editor. And I was very, very grateful to have this opportunity. But I believe when I first entered into the position, you had this collection, Margaret, and you shared it with me. It was, who was it who sent it to? I
believe Rebecca DeSchweinitz, who's a professor at BYU. Yeah, she had these images of protest signs from BYU.
Yes, and so these are like forwarded. You gave it to me in like a neatly tied package, and I opened them up and I started looking at them and was like, these are fantastic. And I remember, you know, us talking and saying that, like, they weren't aesthetically, super aesthetically pleasing. They're kind of like, you know, done like meme culture. And so at the same time, I think I was thinking these are just like so rich. This is like a treasure trove of documentation of how people were thinking during a very kind of and continued kind of conflict. The time of confliction over LGBTQ plus rights at BYU. And so as I started looking through these protest posters, I started thinking like, well, what does this like mean for our moment? And in terms of like protest itself, there's a long history of how that relates to art. And especially in the 20th century, we've started to see different kind of highlights of protest posters that called like agitprop in museums. I know the Brooklyn Museum did one something in 2015 on just agitprop that I went to, and I was like, oh, I had never thought about art through this lens as much. And so I kind of wanted to put it in those narratives of like, how has art communicated a message that needed to be heard? And what are the strategies that are being used by protesters to make themselves legible? And is there a language that is particular to our time? And so for me, since a lot of these posters were just basically memes. Like there was the, I start out an article with the shocked Pikachu meme. And that one is a image of Pikachu who is like from the Pokemon series, and his mouth is open in awe and shock. And it's supposed to kind of like demonstrate that, like, even though we knew this is what was going to happen, we're still shocked, right? It's like, it's still shock and awe. So it's this interesting way, and I think of it also akin to like emojis, it's this interesting way in a digital age of relaying emotion and relaying how we're feeling about something, right? And it's also kind of this tongue-in-cheek humor that I think that I don't know, for me was really, really fascinating to witness. So my larger argument in that article based on these posters is that there's a visual language here. And it's a language that I think we can't ignore in this current moment where we're starting to see more kind of cultural wars. And especially as we move into this presidency, I think I became the art editor a few right alongside actually when Trump was elected to office in 2020. And so I was just kind of playing off of what I was seeing in kind of like the contemporary art world and museum curation and institutional kind of policing of art and expression, alongside how folks were kind of pushing back a little bit more against this. And then I think the question I was asking is like, is there anything particular to Mormonism here that we could also pull out? And for me, that's like my larger research, is that Mormonism is kind of this, not just digital, but it's a technological kind of religion. And so this for me was like very exciting to see a technological language, something that goes across all of these social media boards and posts, to see that kind of move into the public domain or the physical world, right? The digital and the physical kind of merging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have this really interesting connections to historical protest and spaces of public discourse. And it was interesting to me because there's a lot of talk right now about the sort of erosion of a shared public language, right? A shared sort of way of understanding the world, that we no longer all watch the nightly news and have our language filtered through, you know, an anchor who we all recognize, right? And so there's what we see is, you know, obviously a real fracturing in society. But what you're talking about is through meme culture, there is this shared language, and that memes are almost the vehicle through which people are then interpreting current events. So you invoke Jürgen Habermas and the idea of the public sphere. So what does it look like when what you call the coffee house debate culture of Habermas moves onto platforms like Instagram?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So beginning with Habermas, right, like a lot of his kind of analysis and a lot of his work is kind of entrenched in the French Revolution, in the coffee houses of the French Revolution. And so I am wondering if there's any parallels we can make there, right? Like as an art historian, I'm always looking at what happened before and how people used public spaces or private spaces to kind of communicate and to mobilize a public. And so for me, I don't think it paints as evenly as I would love it to onto social media as a public sphere. But I do feel like, you know, and this is also something that other scholars that I cited in the paper have kind of talked about a little bit, is the digital kind of becoming the public in some ways, outside of, you know, some of the limitations that Congress is starting to kind of put on it, as well as like the privatization of certain organizations like X, right? And the trying to make sure that there's stringent measures that kind of mediate those realms. At the same time, I am wondering, like, where are we being mobilized then, right? Like, and I think that's one of the things that Habermas talks about, is these coffee houses are these areas where people are receiving or receiving and transmitting particular types of information, right, to mobilize them against kind of like the monarchy. And I don't know, I guess in that sense, for me, social media is that place. It's the place where, and especially the internet culture at large, if we look at kind of feminist readings of the internet, you know, early internet culture, when you could have like the Wild West, I guess, as some scholars like put it, right, where you have kind of free reign to do things. You have a lot of trans and non-binary folks who are going on there, and they're able to create these avatars and embody kind of something that isn't socially accepted in the public sphere, right, in the physical world, where there's less of a risk of violence of appearing as you feel you need to appear in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's something there about maybe that freedom of exchange, not just in terms of personhood, right? Ability to say what you want in a space that seems relatively safer, right, than the real world outside that, or whatever you want to call it, the non-digital. But at the same time, I think that it's where the exchange of ideas is really happening. It's where I've seen, and this is more anecdotally, right, but I think scholars have also backed this up, and I've cited a few of them in my paper, but I think that's where a lot of the public debates are happening. I see on like Facebook, my relatives are fighting on there, right? And a lot, and I think that's given like a bad name, you know, like we shouldn't be doing this, you know, this is sowing more discord. The algorithm does have an influence on us and tries to, you know, give rise to, you know, like various things to get us more engaged, mm-hmm. on the one hand. On the other hand, like, I've seen like uncles and aunts and various relatives who have stated things more explicitly and then also been kind of called in by their children or by other relatives. And in Mormonism, I think this is a really fascinating thing. And I know that I'm just... Rosemary Avance is one person who talks about it, as well as Gavin Feller and John Durham Peters. They all talk about kind of that space being, you know, a space that suits Mormons really well, because we've always kind of used technology as a way to explain our spiritual existence in a lot of ways. And so I think there's this... interesting dialogue between a lot of my Mormon relatives in particular, who have really, really latched on to something like Facebook. And that's a different generation, right? So you're going to see generationally very different platforms used, but them reacting to one another, even with memes, you know? And so I think that's significant. And I think it shows us not only like a verbal, you know, like, or audible, I don't know if you want to call a written culture, sorry, not audible, but a written culture alongside an artistic culture with memes that react to like something they think is stupid. And I don't know if that's more respectful than what was happening, you know, during the French Revolution and coffee shops. But I just know that that's where I'm seeing a lot of the debate taking place these days.
Yeah. So you referenced Shocked Pikachu, which is one of my favorites of the posters that you shared, which we printed several in the issue, so you can see them. I mean, Shocked Pikachu is inherently a humorous meme, right? I mean, it's used somewhat as a joke. I mean, it's a children's cartoon figure. So how does humor or irony change the emotional tone of protest? And particularly when you're in a setting that is as controlled and kind of serious as BYU. I mean, BYU is a very earnest space. So what does it mean to use to take a, I mean, these protests were no laughing matter. The students felt very seriously about it, but they were wielding this humorous figure.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's not one that I go too much into detail in the article. And so I would love to kind of hear additional thoughts on how humor and irony kind of function within a protest environment. I do think that it does add a little bit of levity to an otherwise difficult, you know, like situation, one that is very harmful for a lot of students. And it does maybe lighten kind of like that atmosphere to some extent. I feel like humor can be used, and we talk about this a lot in LGBTQ plus studies, or I think there's also memes across like the internet about like when I talk to my therapist and then I made a joke to make them laugh, right? And they're like, no, that's not okay, right? But I think like we use humor sometimes to work through, right, a lot of our social kind of triggers maybe or difficulties. And I feel like Shocked Pikachu or some of the others, I think when you can kind of invoke laughter or look at that in that way, I think there is something, I don't know, like I'm not sure, there's something for me that adds levity to an otherwise really sad situation.
Yeah, I mean, the political cartoon has been powerful for the history of, at least for the United States, right, has been used very effectively in the United States. And, but what I think is kind of interesting as a comparison is in the political cartoon, the humor, to understand it, you need to know the political background or the political context. First, Shocked Pikachu, the humor is in the Pikachu figure. It is external to the subject. So, yeah, I feel like it is both drawing on a history of artistic protest, but it's a very different kind of humor because the humor is outside of the subject.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And it makes me think of an article or a chapter that Nathan Rees wrote in our book on Mormon art. He talks kind of about political cartoons and race and things like that. But I think you're completely right that there's something there that allows, for us to kind of identify, I guess, ourselves in it, or brings us in or calls us in a little bit to the familiar in a way that feels less harmful, I guess, or painful, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. So these posters were removed quickly from campus, but they lived on online, particularly through this Instagram account, Honor Code Stories. Do you think the ephemerality is important to the experience of this protest art? And how does it tie into meme culture?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question too. I do think, I mean, in the article, I kind of talk about the ways that, I don't know, the posters were probably exhibited, right, in these spaces, maybe taken down probably at certain points. I know that Rebecca had, you know, taken photos of each poster and kept them in an archive, which I think was so smart, right, to do, because I think someone might look at these posters and be like, this is just for one-time use. Not a lot of people keep that. So there is this ephemerality to them where they aren't preserved usually as much. And one might not think of doing that, I think, at BYU, especially because a lot of people don't think of BYU as this protest environment either, as you noted. And so, I think there's a few archives at play here, basically, right? Like, I think the first is the ones that people like Rebecca are creating by documenting and keeping those objects digital in some form or another and passing those along so we as historians can write about them. The second was really interesting. The second archive that I found was the digital, right? Like you said, there was the at Honor Code Stories, which was kind of the catalyst for the BYU protests that allowed people to know when and where and how are we going to meet and be together. And then afterwards, they documented what was going on, right? So there were photos of people with the posters. I was able to find out more about these, not just through those Instagram accounts or hashtags that allowed me to kind of like search for like hashtag queer at BYU or hashtag honor code, right? But I was also able to find it through like news stories as well that were covering it, especially like KSL that showed some of those posters to kind of connect those dots. But yeah, I think the ephemerality of that, of those, kind of contrasted somewhat with the internet. At the same time, when I went back to some of those hashtags and some of those accounts, some of them were deleted. And that became a little bit tricky because I knew that those were probably significant in mobilizing people and in communications, but they no longer existed in a format that I could access as a historian. And I think that's why our archives are really, really important, right? And what we collect is really important because, and I don't know if this makes me a hoarder because I do collect everything, but I do think that those things tell a story that allow us to kind of reflect on like, what are we doing here, right? And why are people doing this? So I find that fascinating. And then I think the photograph itself, like through the art historical kind of lens, right, as a documentation medium, already assumes that we can never access that moment ever again, right? It's the kind of the crux of performance art in the 70s is that you have all of these people who are doing these amazing things to try and bypass the museum commodifying their art. And yet the photograph is the only thing, or the video is the only thing that is the residue of that. And so we have to ask ourselves, what was actually the performance here? And so that relationship between the ephemeral and the long-lasting, right, the archive, or I guess the document itself, I think plays out really interestingly in this case study of BYU, of what can be kept and then what is thrown away, and what is the actual thing that we're looking at when we look at an image.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, this has been so interesting. I guess I'm wondering, looking back, I mean, these protests happened several years ago. Do you have any sense of what, and I know this wasn't your thesis, but do you have any sense of what the long-term significance of the queer at BYU moment might be for BYU, for queer Latter-day Saints, and for protest movements in religious spaces? Do you have a sense of like what does this mean for us as a people?
Yeah, that's a really good question, like the lasting kind of impacts of this. And it's hard for me to kind of tell the future, but I do know that like Audre Lorde, right, talks about revolution not happening overnight, right? Like, and it doesn't happen in a single gesture. It happens in like a series of gestures over time. And so I think if we're looking at it institutionally through like how it may have impacted BYU, I mean, BYU didn't change its honor code, right? Like it kind of doubled down after this. At the same time, you know, this was recorded, this was seen by the world, this wasn't just in, you know, localized news sources, this was on like NPR. And so people saw it across the world. And for me, that is like a little notch in the clock, right? Like it's what gets us a little bit closer, at least hopefully, right? So on an institutional level, that would be my hope, is that it allows administrators to kind of know that if they were to make a change, that it might be accepted in this way, or it might be rejected or protested by the students themselves. And to have, you know, hundreds of students and hundreds of locals kind of show up to give their voice to that cause, I think is really, really significant, even if it didn't make the biggest change institutionally. On a personal level, for the students who went through that, I think it was, you know, at least from what I gleaned from a lot of the accounts of Queer at BYU, for instance, right, it was affirming. It showed that they were not alone. It showed that the community rallied to make sure that they could be loved, and to that their voices were platformed, right? It was a way of showing support. And I don't think that's something that doesn't have an impact, right? When someone comes and lends their voice to yours when you're struggling, that to me is really, really significant, and affirms their existence, right? It doesn't, I think a lot of times when we're at BYU, being queer at BYU, and I went to BYU and I am queer, I went to BYU Idaho for a year. And I think feeling that way while you're there is very lonely, right? So students, hearing other students, community is such a powerful thing, right? Especially a localized community. And I always believe in the power of ripple effects as well. So we might not feel like that gesture is huge, but just how we treat the people around us can allow us to continue to pay that kindness forward. And so I think that was really significant in a lot of those students' lives and in that moment. I know it was for mine, even as an alma mater, as someone who only went for a year, but as someone who felt very alone.
Thank you so much for sharing that, and particularly being willing to share your personal story. I think that's a beautiful note to end on. So I am going to conclude by thanking the audience for joining us on Dialogue Out Loud today for this conversation about meme culture and BYU protest art. And thank you, Amanda, for helping us think about visual language with new eyes. And to our listeners, if this episode sparked something for you, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, keep asking better questions. And don't forget to subscribe to Dialogue Out Loud, leave a review, and share this episode with someone who could use it. You can read the entire article for free at dialoguejournal.com and see this amazing protest art with new eyes. I'm Margaret Olson Hemming with our art editor, Amanda Beardsley. Thank you for listening.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study, In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.